Hello, my name's Grant Bartley, and you're listening to the pilot edition of the Philosophy Now radio show. My guest tonight will be Mark Vernon, talking about his book, How to Be an Agnostic, and Peter Cave talking about his book, How to Think Like a Bat. So, obviously, the title of this programme is How to Think Like an Agnostic Bat. First of all, I want to get the philosophical temperature of the guys. I want to ask them both the same question, which is, what is philosophy and why is it important to you? So, Mark, would you like to answer that question first?
Good evening. Hello. I think philosophy means something rather fascinating to me. It means a kind of delight in insights, and maybe the kind of insights where you make a little distinction and you discover something new. And it, for me, the lead really does come from Plato who I studied, and that's how I got into philosophy. He liked to ask not so much the questions about what we know and how we know things, but how we live. And that led him to, well, really set an agenda that still we carry to this day.
So that ties in with your book on agnosticism we'll be talking about later, which is philosophy is about a way of life to you.
Yeah, very much so.
Okay. Peter, what about you? What's philosophy to you and why is it important?
I wonder how I dare disagree to saying that philosophy is a kind of life to me. Sounds very, very good. I suppose I'm more influenced by Wittgenstein, though I'm very keen on Plato. But I'd say really philosophy is about understanding our understanding of the world. And in the way of looking at that, it really is a matter, I think, of somehow being, as Mark maybe said, bedazzled, amazed by certain incongruities in our understanding of the world, and yet then trying to quell those amazements and trying to see our ways through them.
To you, philosophy is more like a way of mining amazing ideas, for instance.
It certainly is amazing. Also, there's another amazing feature of it in that you can do it with a glass of red wine, yeah, or indeed white wine. Whereas if you're a scientist, you have to go out into dicey laboratories and risk blowing yourself up. Whereas a philosopher likes sitting in an armchair with a glass of wine, thinking. So it's a wonderful subject.
Yeah, and it's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it. OK.
I'm not sure I was talking about dirtiness there, but do know I do live in Soho.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to just crack on straight away with the interviews then. So let me tell you a bit more about Peter Cave, who's going to be the first interview. He teaches philosophy at the Open University and is chair of the Humanist Philosophers of Great Britain. His new book is called How to Think Like a Bat, and it's available from Quercus. Now, could you tell us a bit about this new book of yours, please, Peter?
Well, I certainly could. Would you like me to?
Yes, please.
Ah, that's very quick thinking there. It really is a book which is meant to be accessible to people to get them into the idea of the puzzles, the perplexities of understanding the world. So I think there's really two very, very big issues here. One issue is to think about the nature of the world around us. How do we understand space and time?
Okay.
But another big issue is understanding morality, about things which we ought to do. And so we could talk more about bats. I don't think bats have any sense of morality.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it may be of interest to try to think like a bat.
Could they have bat morality, do you think?
Or you may call it batty morality, but then that applies to some human beings as well. But I'm not looking at Mark when I say that.
I found it to be rather like a course in modern philosophical thinking of in terms of ethics and logic.
And also metaphysics and epistemology, just to use some big words.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. Epistemology is like how you can know things. Metaphysics is the study, I suppose, of the fundamental nature of reality.
Well, Grant, why do you assume all the listeners are guys?
That's a generic term.
Oh, I see. Does it apply to porcupines too?
If there's any listening, which I doubt.
I look forward to the porcupine response, or indeed the bat's response.
Would you think a porcupine would like to think like a bat?
No. I think a porcupine doesn't think much, but then some human beings don't. So I would claim that the value of my book, and indeed Mark's books and other people's books, is really to encourage people to think well, to think very carefully about the nature of morality, the nature of the world, about consequences of arguments. And so although you're perfectly correct in saying that the book is very much raising contemporary issues, dare I say there's sufficient references to Plato and Aristotle and Wittgenstein to interest those with interest in
your motivation ideas. Is to for people to think well.
Enlightenment.
Right. How do you know that the well you're telling them to think is good thinking?
Once it is deeply explained, it becomes self-evident. some things, when you go through them step by step, people do just tend to end up seeing that, oh yes, that is a good argument, as opposed to that's a bad argument. People foolishly, I think, often say there's no right or wrong answers in philosophy. That is a dreadful mistake. There are some right or wrong answers. For example, if someone said all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is not mortal, that would just be wrong. That's a bad argument, full stop. And there's no argument about that argument.
Okay, so you want people fundamentally to be logical, and you want to encourage them in
no.
knowing the way to be logical. No?
I want people to be logical, but also to be emotional, also to enjoy the delights of the world, to enjoy the wine,
okay.
but also the sunsets,
okay,
to enjoy music, et al.
Let me put the question another way. You want all these other things to be compatible, logically compatible with their logicalness, which means that it all makes sense when added together. Nothing contradicts.
I'm not sure if you're up to this, Grant, but I'd even be prepared to disagree with you there.
I think
there are some
Go
fundamental
ahead.
Contradictions in our understanding of morality, and I think we just have to face that. We have to face that. There are indeed moral dilemmas in which we muddle through, and there probably are contradictions
okay.
built into those concepts.
Like, give me an example from your book of what you mean by a fundamental irresolvable moral contradiction, for instance?
Well, I can give you many sorts of examples, but just think how people often find a clash of different values. So in current Britain, for example, there was much discussion about whether it was fair or not to detain people without trial, without telling them what they're going to be found guilty or innocent of, without knowing what they're being accused of. And so you've got to compare, contrast indeed, that sort of concern about someone's human rights with the other concern about how to protect the society from terrorist bombers.
Couldn't that just be a case of people not really having thought through what's involved in these processes?
Well, do you think there's any way of measuring this rather dicey concept of human rights or the rights to a fair trial and so on with another concept to do with overall human welfare? Well, I could give you many other examples. Think how some people say, really, it's grossly unfair to have inheritance tax or to be taxed at 50%, whereas other people say, obviously, that's fair. Well, how can we understand fairness to resolve that problem?
Okay, so basically, tell me if I'm right here, but you're saying that there are some things that you can't really resolve, ultimately speaking, so you've got to live with the paradox. This is quite an agnostic stance, isn't it?
No, I think there's... Yes and no. I think there are some things which deeply sincere people might come to deep disagreements over, and there's no resolution. I can give you another, perhaps a more immediate example. It might well be the case that two women are pregnant, and one really thinks that she's a very sincere person and she really thinks she should have an abortion. And the other woman, in exactly the same situation, really thinks she ought not to have an abortion. Right. I suspect that with regard to each of their lifestyles, they might both be right because they are actually different types of people.
They'd have different reasons for thinking what they do, but there's no external way of saying that you're right and you're wrong.
I tend to say in that case they're both right in following their deep beliefs there. A famous example which is mentioned in my, dare I say, How to Think Like a Bat book, that's called A Promotion, is it, Grant? Is Jean-Paul Sartre, when he tells a story in the Second World War of how a student was anguishing about whether he should stay behind in France to look after his aged mother, or whether in fact he should join the resistance movement. And he actually had reasons for both sides of that debate, and as Sartre said, at the end of the day, he just has to make a choice. He has to leap into one valuation being stronger than the other valuation.
I mean, do you think that's really typical of human life to make these sort of unjustified choices?
I think, sadly, if people haven't thought about philosophy or indeed read these discussions of these issues, people often tend to think there's an immediate black or white answer, and that really depresses me. And so one good reason for reading philosophy and to thinking about these topics we discuss in our books is to be aware that when you read the Daily Mail or indeed the Guardian, there are probably some outrageous comments being made without any good reasoning behind them, and that does concern me. It particularly concerns me, for example, of Dave, we're all in it together, Cameron, getting away with that statement. I think that's called a political comment.
One question I want to ask you. There's 35 articles, would you say, in your How to Think Like a Bat book?
I think the technical term is chapters.
Chapters, okay. And at first, if you look at the chapter headings, they don't seem to be connected, like how to be God, how to avoid being seduced by logic. But I got the impression that there was a connection of thinking and logic. So the book is basically about thinking, hence the title. Would you say that's right? Or what is your agenda for the book?
Well, inevitably, if someone's reading a philosophy book, they should be thinking. So that's undoubtedly part of the story.
It's thinking about thinking in this case, rather than about morality or
yes, indeed.
Anything else.
But it does make the case somewhere to remind us that there's a lot of value on occasions in not thinking, but just in experiencing the world. There's a value in experiencing the sunset, or a value in experiencing the ocean, or indeed love, without thinking about it, quote, logically. And so that's why I was feeling a bit uneasy, Grant, when you tried to make me out to be writing a book purely to do with logic and reasoning,
okay.
Because sometimes that misleadingly leads people into thinking that, oh, well, logic is bound to be cold, it's bound to be dismissive
mean,
of emotion.
And you've got to
whereas we enjoy emotions,
element.
We enjoy the conflicts.
Your book is very accessible and it's written for the general public, so...
Do I have to slip you a fiver to say
you
that?
You don't have... You just have to promote good thinking, Peter.
Good thinking. And the appreciation of times when you ought not to be thinking.
I did think, rather that this was... rather than how to think like a bat, it did seem to me how to think like Peter Cave. What do you think about that?
Well, if other people were to think like me, it would be a wonderful world, wouldn't it? But
sure?
It might be a little bit tedious, because I do enjoy the idea of different views. So as we know, shortly Mark will be talking maybe from a more religious viewpoint, although he's now an agnostic.
An agnostic viewpoint.
But as you also know, I'm an atheist. I chair the Humanist Philosophers Group of Great Britain. And so although I am an atheist, I really do enjoy the existence of certain religious traits. I certainly enjoy the existence of religious music, and sometimes I would listen to evensong and so on. So I think variety is itself of great value. Another example in which philosophy is very valuable, I think, is people often say, oh, well, what's the point of philosophy?
Yeah.
Well, one valuable item in philosophy, I think, is to remind people that sometimes things can be valuable without a point. So what's the point of football? Well, people will just say football is itself
so
intrinsically valuable.
If
and
you
they
enjoy
might...
something, that's its own point.
That sometimes is its own point. But equally, cultivating a garden is its own point for some people. Playing chess, maybe winning or losing, can be
so
going to a rock
the
concert.
The principle here is whatever makes you happy or whatever makes you healthy.
No, I think that's a mistake. I think it's a mistake immediately to say, oh, well, it must be because of happiness or it must be because of satisfactions. I think some things are valuable in themselves.
Yeah. I think there's lots of things that are beneficial to people, not just happiness. There's freedom and
truth
and things like that.
One way you can handle that, Grant, is if you take someone like John Stuart Mill, who is associated with maximising in pleasure or happiness, if you read Mill carefully, you'll see that his understanding of happiness does include these other values, such as freedom, such as dignity, and so on. And that's why, indeed, dear Mill says it's better to be a dissatisfied Socrates than a satisfied pig.
I think that's a very wide-ranging use of the word happiness, but we're not...
But you can see how Mill is not a straightforward satisfaction theorist, whereas many economists wrongly attribute it to him.
OK, which of these 35 chapters reflect or are closest to your core area of interest to you? And would you like to tell us a bit about that one?
I suppose my core area of interest, apart from having the red wine... Perhaps I ought not to keep on mentioning that.
Yeah,
do you think I'm alcoholic?
There. He's deceiving you, listeners.
Yes,
he's
water,
got water.
They didn't offer me any alcohol this evening.
Yeah, well, I know what you like.
But you know what I like? That's another issue. But with regard to your particular question, I think what I find very interesting in philosophy are clashes, are incongruities. Often they're in terms of paradoxes, but a very accessible one is in a chapter about how to be free. Because if you think about it, in our everyday lives, we blame people, we praise people, we say they deserve things, we say they ought to be punished and so on. So our very nature of our conceptual scheme, our understanding of the world, is to think people can freely do things and then they deserve praise or blame, blah, blah. And yet equally so, if we stand back, if we detach ourselves a little bit, then we'll probably go along with a scientific understanding, saying, well, hold on, all those human actions are caused by changes inside the brain, and those have been caused by other changes which were caused by your genetic makeup and your environment. And so there's an intrinsic clash between the scientific determinism of understanding human behaviour and our everyday life.
I don't see why it has to be a clash, though. Can't you say that it's you that is making the choices? I mean, there has to be something that you're going to be making a choice about. So there has to be something that exists before the choice. So what's wrong with saying, although the whole state of the universe before you make the choice or whatever is caused, it's still you that's making the choice, and therefore that's what free...
Indeed, that's one line of approach. But then somebody might say, but I couldn't help being me, and why should I be blamed for being a guy who is naturally, I don't know, a kleptomaniac? Or being a guy who likes stealing knickers from Harvey Nichols or whatever, if I can't actually help it.
Sure, but you'd be hard-pushed to prove that you couldn't have made an alternative choice in any given situation, right?
Well, some people might say, looking at your neural structures and so on, it really is the case those were going to be the actions which were the result of those neural structures. But there's a genuine problem there. I suppose just take people who might be listening who are smokers but would rather not be smokers.
Right.
They have a desire to avoid the desire for smoking, and yet they may not be able to satisfy that desire because they've got the smoking habit. And it's too casual, isn't it, to say, oh, well, they could just stop.
Well, it's different horses for courses, isn't it?
That means either.
It means you take each case individually.
I approve of that, yes. Case by case. Yes.
Case by case studies.
So I'd be arguing very much against generalisations, apart from that generalisation.
Well, generalisations have their place too, I'm sure.
But what's that generalisation?
It's like metaphors. You've got to know the limits of it, don't you, really? From the evidence of your book and other things that I've read by you, you seem obsessed by logical paradoxes. What do you think paradoxes reveal about what it is to think like a human being?
You couldn't avoid, could you, dear Grant, slipping the word logical paradoxes.
Oh, well, I'm happy. Well, paradoxes, logical paradoxes.
Yes. But yes, they are some clash in the reasoning, that's true. And I do find that fascinating because I think that is at the heart of our conceptual schemes, our understanding of the world. I really think...
Paradoxes?
Well, these clashes. It's an example of a clash again. So I'm talking in a very general sense about these clashes. So I've given you the example of free will and determinism, as it's known in the trade. But take perhaps a more accessible example. Many people are lovers. They fall in love with each other. Now, just think of this clash from within, from the way in which you're looking, from the way in which, say, Jack is looking at his beloved Jill. He just loves things about Jill, and Jill loves things about Jack. Jill might say, I love Jack because he's kind, he's got a coquettish walk, he wears his nail varnish rather nicely, and so on. And so Jill really loves Jack for various features, features F, G, and H, blah, blah. But, of course, if that really is the correct analysis of it, then anybody else would do with features F, G, and H. And yet... So if you take a detached, objective viewpoint, you might say, well, come off it, Jill. Anybody who's like Jack with regard to the coquettish walk and smile and so on would be as good for your lover as Jack. And yet from the attached viewpoint, from within that loving relationship, Jill, and indeed Jack, would be appalled if they started saying, well, anybody else would have done with the same properties. So we've got the clash between the attached viewpoint and the detached. And I could relate that, if I may, to the bat.
So we live...
I'm not allowed to relate
that
to the bat.
Because of all the other stuff, apart from logic, we are capable of living with paradox. Is that probably...
I think we do live with clashes, and a feature of philosophy, though, is to see quite where the clash is, whether there are ways of overcoming it or ways of reconciling it. And in some cases there are, some cases there aren't.
OK, well, seeing as you were talking about love just now, finally I want to ask you, do llamas fall in love, Peter Cave?
Ah, is this a plug for my other book called
Do
Llamas Fall in
Love? This is an opportunity to plug your last book, yes.
33 Perplexing Philosophy Puzzles.
Oh, that sounds good.
That sounds a very good book, doesn't it?
And what's it called?
With cartoons, too. I think it's called Do Llamas Fall in Love.
Okay.
You can see I'm trying to avoid giving the answer.
No, I want you to give the answer.
Why is trying to avoid that? I think, in the end, I probably say llamas do not fall in love. They can sort of go around with each other, they can sort of make sure they don't lose each other and so on. But if you love someone, don't you need to be acting sometimes in their interests, but acting freely in their interests? You know, you could just decide to go with your own self-interest, but you think, no, I'll give my beloved the glass of wine or my beloved the holiday.
So llamas don't fall in love because they're incapable of acting freely, that's what you're saying?
I think the bottom line is that there are many things to do with having reasons why you love someone, acting in their interests, and those do require something to do with free will. Yes.
Okay, and that's
you're
great.
You're wondering
Peter.
What to say now, aren't you?
I'm wondering how to move into the track, but
I wanted to move into bats, but never mind. Let's move into a track.
Okay.
A track of bats.
I can quickly ask you, how can I think like a bat?
I don't know the answer to that, but I was trying to say that with regard to the question about bats, It's a well-known question about if scientists learnt everything there is to know about bats. They chopped up the neurology, they actually learnt about the ecosystem and so on. So that would be the detached viewpoint, standing back. Nonetheless, wouldn't they still always be missing what it's like for a bat to experience, to think of
sure,
the world?
I agree with
and
that
so that's
totally.
A great clash again.
Science.
But I think you're passing me on to a little bit of my music. Aren't
yes,
you?
Would you like to introduce the track, please? No.
I wish I knew what it's called, but it's by Berio, and it's a wonderful part from his Symphonia. It's
okay.
One part of it.
So I hope you enjoy this, ladies and gentlemen.
And it's very much geared to Samuel Beckett's You Must Keep Going. Go on.
Hello, everybody in radio space. This is Grant Bartley from Philosophy Now magazine, and you're listening to the first edition of the Philosophy Now radio show. I have with me now my guest, Mark Vernon, talking about his book, How to Be an Agnostic. Now, Mark is an ex-Anglican priest and is now a full-time writer. Mark, so the first question I want to ask you is, what do you mean by agnostic, and why do you think it's important to promote agnosticism rather than, say, atheism or even theism, I suppose?
I guess the reason for that really is a personal one, ultimately, is that, as you said, I used to be a clergyman, and I left, and for a while I was quite a convinced atheist,
right.
Conviction atheist, but then
go through your story in the book, I should say, to the...
Yeah, listeners. And then so 2 or 3 years later on after that, I realised I wasn't really an atheist and
right.
had to sort of try and work out what that meant, and agnosticism was the word, but it's a rather unfortunate word in some ways because it tends to mean, in colloquial conversation, a sort of the whatever approach to life.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, and probably I don't really care that much. I did care quite a lot, and I think what it's about, for me, agnosticism, is something to do with the human condition ultimately, which
right.
I think is to know a certain amount, but also to be very conscious of what one doesn't know. And in some ways, in a strange kind of way, the more... that one appreciates what one doesn't know, the more fascinating life gets.
Okay, I see, because there's this sort of mystery element to it. That's
yeah, there's
added,
mystery and wonder. And,
to
and of course, I think both the religious quest at its heart and indeed the scientific quest at its heart are about pushing back the boundaries of what one can know and experience.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I mean, isn't the desire to know slightly contradictory to a stance of deliberate not knowing, let's say?
I actually think that the not knowing follows quite naturally from... the knowing. It's not an anti sort of knowledge stance, if you like. I studied physics at one point, and one of the things that you learn when you do a degree in physics, as opposed to say an O level or an A level, is that modern physics is premised on a thing called the uncertainty principle. And this is not just like a little addition to physics.
I'm not
this
sure
is
what
actually
that is.
This is actually underpins quantum mechanics. The uncertainty principle is the idea that if you want to take a measurement of say an electron, you can take a measurement of its momentum, but the more closely you get to know its momentum, the less closely you get to know its speed.
So basically,
its position.
It's built into the universe that you can't know everything. Yeah.
Yeah, and what's the dynamic there is that the more closely you attend to one thing, the less you understand something else. And that, for me, is something. There's something in there about the agnostic spirit more generally, that whilst we live in an age which knows an enormous amount about certain kinds of things, it's like other things slip from our view, as it were, and we have to then attend to that too.
Isn't it fair to say that quantum physics might be a transient scientific theory, because many quantum physicists will say they don't really understand it, and so who knows what the theory will be in 50 years' time? But tell me, Mark, is your agnosticism wider than just with concern with God, then?
Well, yes.
I mean, obviously, as an atheist would recognise there's many things we don't know, but I'd find it very, very odd to be agnostic about God, just as I'd find it odd to be agnostic about some supernatural yellow leprechauns which we can't see under this desk.
This ties a lot with your whole chapter on Socrates in your book, doesn't it?
Let me pick up on that. I think the difference perhaps between the conviction atheist and the agnostic where I find myself is that I think atheism entails, or often does, the idea that really human beings are, as it were, the best judges of what's the case. Man is the measure of all things,
right.
is the famous phrase from
Protagonist. I strongly disagree with that, because that implies a relativism. And although I am an atheist, I'm certainly not a relativist. I don't think morality is just a matter of picking and choosing.
But I don't think you're a relativist either, are you, Mark?
No, I guess that I would have faith, that if you like, that there is such a thing as truth, but it's beyond us, and that to be human...
There's many truths here which aren't beyond you. You know, you're sitting inside a studio. That's true.
We're talking specifically about theological agnosticism, would you say, rather than general, I don't know anything about anything. Is that right?
No. I think the agnostic spirit is something that actually permeates all the way through human activities,
so
through
I'm
the
really
religious question.
You don't Peter, know inside a studio.
It'd be quite a good idea if I could finish the sentence.
Let him finish his sentence, Peter.
Grant said to have an argument.
No.
Well, an argument normally entails an exchange of well-formulated positions, not just an interruption.
Well, I'm waiting for the well-formulated position.
Thank you very much. Listen on. Yeah, I think Socrates is kind of the hero of my book.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that the reason why Socrates is such a seminal figure for us is that he realised that the key to wisdom, this philosophy, this love of wisdom which he set up, is appreciating the limits of our knowledge as much as appreciating what we can say and so on. And in fact, many of the Socratic dialogues, as they're called, that Plato read, really quite common questions, normal questions like what's it to be a friend, what's courage and so on, they end in what the philosophers called aporia, which is this pause where you realise there's a whole lot more going on than you ever realised. And to my mind, that speaks very powerfully to what it is to be human. It's Augustine, the theologian, put it rather beautifully. He said that we live between the beasts and the angels.
Sure. I don't think you've answered my question yet, which is really why specifically agnosticism about God, I suppose, or about spiritual matters? And, well, my other question along with that is, what do you mean by spiritual, and what are the limits of what we can know about it, really?
There's different kinds of agnosticism about God. There's a Bertrand Russell agnostic approach to God. Now, Bertrand Russell called himself an atheistically inclined agnostic.
Right.
He was quite strict and logical about it when he was talking in that way. He said that you can't prove a negative, you can't prove that God doesn't exist.
Right.
But for him, there was just so little evidence that he lived as if God doesn't exist, so he lived as an atheist. For myself, I suppose I would be a religiously inclined agnostic, so I sort of look in the opposite direction. That I think that my inspiration more comes from the kind of theology which says that for God to be God, or your concept of God to be worth anything, it's got to be beyond what you can comprehend. Otherwise, you just created an idol, to use religious language.
But that's still believing in a God, isn't it?
Well, if you read the apophatic theologians, these theologians...
Sorry, what's that word again?
It's a theology by negation, by saying what God is not.
Apophatic means a God that is not this or that.
Yeah, it's saying that, by definition, God is going to be beyond your comprehension. So the only way to proceed is by saying God is not this. So, for example, people that go to church will often say God is immortal. It just means that God is not mortal. They'll say God is invisible. It just means God's not visible. Mm-hmm. Now, that's to say something about God, but it's also to be very conscious that the words that you try to use are always inadequate.
Sure.
And the big theologians in the monotheistic traditions all assert this, that our language about God always falls short. And you can't even say God exists, Thomas Aquinas says, because existence is what is attributed to things.
Right.
And for God to be God, God can't just be another thing.
But surely God either exists or doesn't exist, right?
No, he says that you can't... It's actually a nonsensical statement to make about...
May I pick up on those points?
Yeah, sure.
May I pick up on three points, in fact? Earlier on, you seemed to be saying that you didn't think you knew any truth, but I assume you didn't mean to say
I had faith that there's such a thing as truth, actually.
Are you really saying you don't believe it's true? You're sitting inside this studio at this moment.
No, not at all.
No.
I never said that.
So you're not saying that. So you do have some idea of truth. That's an example.
Yeah, fine.
Second point is you announce this claim which Dawkins does, that you can't prove a negative. I can prove to you quite easily there's no elephants in this room, and I can prove to you there's no square circles. So some negatives you can prove, can't you?
Fair enough, yeah.
And then the third point, which distresses me as an atheist, is the manoeuvre which you and many believers or semi-believers or agnostics make about, well, we can't apply these words to God, e.g. the word existence or loving, and yet somehow you do use those words of God, so are you just going to say there's something about which we can say nothing, or there may be something about which we can say nothing?
Do you not have to, first of all, define what you mean by God to deny that it exists?
Well, Thomas Aquinas says you can't even do that. He says you can study physics
you have to fix a reference.
So how does he talk about it, then?
By saying what God is not, and by having a theology by analogy.
Okay, let me
So, for example, I think maybe let's just...
How do you know what you mean by God before? if you say that you can't.
There's a very nice distinction which might help here, which actually John Henry Newman makes, who was recently canonised by the Pope. And he says there's two kinds of assent that we make, two kinds of assent. In mathematics and logic, we make what he calls noetic assent, which is where you can, by sort of rational argument, as it were, decide whether something's true or not. For most of life, though, he says, we have to make what he calls real assent. And that means that we have to bring our whole person to the issue in question. So we bring our experience, we bring our encounters, we bring our intuitions, we bring our culture, our history, and so on. And for the things which actually allow us to live, we have to engage in this much, much bigger kind of task. So philosophy, in that context, mostly serves as a kind of discerning factor. It helps us work out what would certainly not be the case, and it helps us kind of clarify our thought, if you like. But to the question, a big question like whether you believe in God or not, I think you have to, you bring in all sorts of other factors. You bring in an artistic quest as much as anything, an imaginative quest as much as anything. It would be a reflection upon your experience. And when you've kind of sorted through that, as it were, you have to decide whether or not God makes sense in that context.
But presumably you give him some characteristics when you're...
Yeah, so to do is you would want to talk and speak, as it were, and not just immediately fall into silence. But eventually a point would be reached where you would fall into silence, where you'd realise, as it were, that your words collapsed in on themselves. And so that's why mystery is always at the heart of the religious quest.
The first moves, when you're using certain descriptions of God, presumably you feel they are more apt descriptions than the opposite.
Yeah,
otherwise you wouldn't use them.
I guess you borrow from traditions. Traditions being, as if you like, the accumulated wisdom of people that have gone before you, and so
or accumulated mistakes.
Yeah, well, and accumulated mistakes, of course. It's a dynamic process.
Accumulated
for sure,
experience, yeah. We can say diplomatically. Can I ask you this? Given that you can neither conclusively, logically prove or disprove the existence of God, what's wrong with deciding that reasons and evidence can still persuade you one way or the other without proof at the level of mathematics or, you know, a proven scientific theory? What's wrong with saying, okay, still I'm going to take this evidence to be one way or the other? I think the mistake is not to believe in something, but to think that you have proven incontrovertible knowledge when you don't. I think that's a mistake of both atheists and religious people make. I think it's the seeds of authoritarianism. And how does this idea connect with what you call bad faith in your book?
I mean, I think that evidence does count, certainly, but it's not an issue which you have. In certain sciences, evidence is what counts. In mathematics, logic is what counts. But always, even in quite strict sciences, intuition plays a role, the point in time which you come plays a role. And so,
I guess what I'm getting at is, why must it necessarily lead to agnosticism, given that we're going to be a bit more open about what is a justified belief or whatever? Why must it lead to agnosticism? Why isn't atheism okay, or theism? Or...
Well, I mean, the honest answer is that it's a personal reflection to try and make sense of where I find myself.
Okay.
I think that's, for me anyway, that's the way that philosophy works. It's a reflection on your life, as it were, and how you
want that,
and to try and understand things, rather than being, as it were, a logical activity which you undertake and then decide that's where you are.
But you see, Mark, where I find a problem with your position is, at the end of the day, you presumably are going to look at some evidence in favour of God, even though you know nothing about him at times, and you know a little bit about him. But where is that evidence? I mean, it would be like my saying that I should be a fairyist, an agnostic about fairies, because although there's no evidence in favour of fairies, nonetheless, it's logically possible there are fairies at the bottom of my garden, and so maybe I should say I'm agnostic. But nobody seriously says
that. I think you're using
that.
A very heavy use of the word evidence there. I think there's historical evidence, experiential
Sorry, for what?
Evidence. You can
Sorry,
call
for
it.
Fairies?
I mean,
no,
I have
God,
to say, if that's a good argument for not believing in God, I say it's not a very good argument. I mean, fairy belief, for example, does not inspire the building of great cathedrals
forget
music.
About fairy belief.
Let's just have this point. Just because something inspires you, it doesn't make it the case that it exists.
No, but you take it more seriously than just belief in fairies.
No.
Well, fairies have inspired lots of works of art in the
Forget about fairies. I'm not interested in fairies.
I think you're being fairyist.
I want to know, is there progress from agnosticism, given that you're taking a point of view which says, I recognise the limitations of my knowledge? Where do you go from there?
Well, then you have to argue about the way of life which you're going to lead, which I think is challenging, because it's a way of life which is kind of open-ended, as it were. It's not quite sure the ends to which it's going. There are a couple of things which I've been inspired by. I'm very keen on a 20th century philosopher called Simone Weil. Uh-huh. And she has this rather nice idea which she calls gravity and grace. Uh-huh. And gravity is that which would drag you down, and grace is that which would, as it were, feels expansive for your humanity. And so she says, look, we don't know kind of what our end is as human beings, but at any moment we can, as it were, ask ourselves, does this feel expansive, my humanity? Is this making me more of a human being? Is this enriching my experience in life? Is it making demands on me, and so on, in a rewarding way? Or does it just feel a kind of contraction, a reduction of life?
But you don't think you can ever have knowledge, I guess is what I'm asking you, and in which...
Oh, no, I think you can. I mean, as I say, I think that agnosticism is not...
saying you couldn't have knowledge.
No, I didn't. Agnosticism is not the position that's necessary as knowledge. That's called scepticism.
Right.
And I haven't actually used the C word yet.
I think when you play this back, you'll realise at the very beginning you cast a doubt on the nature of truth, even. But perhaps you didn't intend
perfectly
to.
Happy to do that. I think truth is a very complicated
thing. Unfair to Mark's position, Peter. I don't think he was saying anything like that.
Well, we can play it back one day.
Do you take a strong view on knowledge? I mean, do you think knowledge is only what you can actually prove, like mathematically or scientifically?
No, I think knowledge comes in multitude of ways. I mean, there's only one thing that's certainty, and that's pure mathematics. And some people would say, well, that's not certain.
Really? But what about pure logic? Anyway,
so you really don't think you're certain? You're sitting inside a studio at this moment. I'm certain you are.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Yeah, I think seriously.
What I was going to say is there are many different kinds of knowledge, and depending on the criteria which you bring, as it were, to that, you arrive at a satisfactory position, as it were, in knowledge. So I'm perfectly happy to say that I'm sitting in a studio, as it were, talking with you now. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't actually use logic to work that out. I use the extension of my body, for example, my experience in space. That seems to me to be a very good way of proceeding.
Okay, bring it back to the topic of the book, which is particularly agnosticism about God. I find it to be... a sort of map of your relationship to the concept of agnosticism. I mean, you go through lots of different subjects, like how to be an ethical agnostic, how to be a scientific agnostic. But can agnosticism make you happy?
I think it's not necessarily... I think happiness is a bit overrated, actually. We were talking about Mill earlier on. I mean, Mill made the very astute comment, I think, which is that ask yourself whether you're happy and you cease to be so.
Right.
Happiness is a byproduct of life, and the proper question to ask is, what kind of life am I leading? Am I living a good life, as it were, for the creature called a human being?
And your role model for a good life is Socrates, I presume.
Yeah, I think he's just one of these extraordinary figures in history who didn't write anything, but left a kind of constellated, as it were, a human life that still challenges us. He's like religious leaders in that respect, like Jesus, who didn't write anything, like the Buddha, who didn't. And people have been sort of responding to his existence ever since. And so I think he, because of the position he, the imaginative position, as well as anything else that he occupies, that's why he still grips us and becomes the consciousness for a civilization, as Bertrand Russell put it.
So I suppose I find a problem here. You quite reasonably talked about Simone Weil and grace, the enriching of your life through grace. But I, as an atheist, I can understand that. My problem always is, why do you then take this further leap and say, oh, well, maybe, or perhaps in the case of theologians, there is actually a God? And that doesn't actually help the situation at all, because you can enrich a life without being committed to the existence of a supernatural being. And you mentioned Mill, and following Mill, I'd say if you really do think there's some evidence to say there's a designer or a creator of the world, then look around the world. Why ever would you attribute lovingness or kindness or goodness to such a being, given the amount of suffering?
Well,
in the world?
I don't think you can. First of all, I don't think you can assume that what you see in the world is all there is. I think that's an unwarranted
assumption.
But
I'll let you answer that question.
Well, I mean, Peter brings in a lot of assumptions about his God, or the God he doesn't believe in comment.
Just let's make that clear.
and most of the God that Peter was presenting, I wouldn't find a very interesting or plausible God.
Sure.
And in fact, if you read any decent theologians like Thomas Aquinas, in the first pages of his theology, he knocks down most of those assumptions.
Yeah,
so you'd have to come up with a decent concept.
And Augustine out to be agnostics in your book.
But you seem
they embody the agnostic spirit.
But
that was the difference I was trying to make.
You seem to end up believing in a God in which, at the end of the day, you're not prepared to describe in any way. But many, many religious believers do describe him as being all good, all loving, all powerful. You know, that's part of many, many religious texts. And I'm just saying, if you really believe in that, surely you've got to start challenging the all goodness description. All the all-powerful.
I think if what you're pointing there is the problem of evil, the fact that there's evil in the world, I think that is the one very, very good argument against the existence of God. Most other arguments
you're assuming then you do understand God as being all-powerful and all-good.
I think
otherwise
that,
it would
well,
be
that's obvious. That's obviously the common conception of God in monotheistic.
But for Mark,
for Thomas Aquinas, for example, when he affirms that God is all good, but then he says, but we don't really know what we mean by all goodness.
So what's the point of saying is all good then?
No, but that's the difference between the atheist and the agnostic. The agnostic is prepared to believe they don't know what they're talking about when they talk about God.
I understand what you're saying, Mark.
The agnostic is prepared to say they don't know what they're talking about when they talk about God, whereas the atheist thinks they do know what they're talking about when they deny God.
But I think that's
the fundamental
key
difference.
Point, if you really don't know what you're talking about when you're talking about God, why use the word good rather than the word bad?
One uses goodness and then says that, but one doesn't really know what that means. One, as it were, begins with one's own experience as a human being. We have some sense of what it means to be good as a human being. And so in this reaching out, this between the beasts and the angels condition, one tries to make the best sense of one's own language in that effort, which I think is, again, it's just what artists do, it's what science does. There's nothing actually that unusual in that.
Okay, thanks, Mark. We're going to play another track now, and then we're going to just have some concluding questions and remarks. Listen to Osric Tentacles from Pungent Effulgent. I think this is called Dissolution.
Very appropriate.
Hello, you're listening to the Philosophy Now radio show. We're nearly at the end of the programme now. Now, I just want to ask my guests, Mark Vernon and Peter Kay, the final question of the evening, which is, what do your books tell whoever reads them about philosophy and how to do it?
Mark? Well, my inspiration comes from the ancient Greeks, just because I studied Plato and that's how I got into philosophy. And for them, philosophy was a way of life. And that meant, I think, it's not just the effort to try and think clearly and think well, but you have to, as it were, shape your whole existence so that you as much put your psychological life in the right place, as it were. So they formed communities. They also thought communities were very important, because then you get to know people and you form a kind of friendship where things can be sort of deeply tested, not just tested at a rational level. And in a way, they were more like monks than they were like academic
philosophers
today.
Sorry, how does this connect to your book?
Because I think that my inspiration is Socrates, and I think this is the vision of philosophy which Socrates helped to get going.
Yeah, because you do start and finish with Socrates, really, the example that he's made. Peter, how about you? How does your book tell us about philosophy?
Well, as a chastened philosophy for being told off for interrupting, I shall talk more quietly and not be interrupted, I assume, by Mark, which I'm sure is true, in fact. I actually think that my book would enrich people's lives with regard to philosophy in the sense that it does touch on many, many different concepts, which once you start thinking about them, you'll find they're not at all as clear as you might otherwise just assume. So it, for example, talks about whether you know you're dreaming or not. I suspect Mark perhaps might claim he doesn't know. It will talk about self-deception. It will talk about the nature of love, the nature of desire. And once you look at those everyday concepts and look at them with regard sometimes to Plato or Aristotle or Wittgenstein, and just think them through, you'll realise there's far more wonderful things in life than actually one does get by just, say, not thinking about these things, not looking at the world in the way a philosopher does. And so I would tend also to stress that there's a sort of mystical element to philosophy, despite my being an atheist, in the sense that one does have a feeling of awe about the world, and I try to bring that out in the chapter about the meaning of life as well.
Okay.
So I'm not as cold and rational as logical as maybe some people have suggested in this discussion.
Okay, that's great. So we've been talking about the two books, How to Be an Agnostic by Mark Vernon and How to Think Like a Bat, and other 34 other really interesting uses of philosophy by Peter Cave. The Peter Cave book is available from Quercus Publishing, and this has a, for the benefit of the listeners, this has a analytical edge to it. Peter is a very analytical writer, and
it does have quips as well,
and quips
and a few jokes
and
jokes, some cartoons
and cartoons and it looks like a lovely coffee table
and object. Pages
Mark Vernon's book How to Be an Agnostic is a available at the beginning of March from Palgrave Macmillan. This is much more an anecdotal book, a personal journey sort of book through agnosticism and all its implications. I should mention also that my book, The Meta Revolution, is available from Amazon, or for a limited period only, is available on Kindle for 99p. So that's the bargain of the week. So I urge you to go out and buy all these things immediately. Thank you.